the magic of radio and the magic of the telephone company. We put those two magics together, and we're going to go out to Clay City, Illinois, for a conversation with a gal who contributed a great deal to the what is now known as the Golden Age of Radio. Hello, Bernadine Flynn.
Hello, Chuck.
How are you today?
Well, I'm fine. Well, I'm only disappointed to not be able to be with you people in Chicago at this beautiful festival.
Yeah, the Chicago Comedy Festival, sponsored by the University of Chicago, is going to be a great event, and we will be saddened by your absence, but happy to have this chance to chat with you a little bit.
Thank you, and may I offer my congratulations to the University of Chicago Extension Division, of course, first of all, for bringing about this tribute to Chicago's contribution to American humor, and some special gratitude to the immediate participants, like Mary Frances Rimer, and dear Franklin McMahon, Gene Shepard, Frank Walsh, Chuck Shaden, and other illustrious people who have done so much and have made it a success even before it takes place.
Well, you were very responsible for the success of the Vic and Sade radio series. When did you first see a Vic and Sade script?
1932, I think it must have been. I saw the first script, so...
You saw the first script,
yes.
Right.
Yes. Well, that is the first script that was offered to us for audition purposes.
How did that come about for you? How did you get the opportunity to audition for the series?
Well, I was just another actress floating around the Chicago NBC studios. When Paul Reimer wrote it, he was then employed in the script department of NBC. And I just happened to be their great good luck, as all the rest of us were. And somehow, when you say I contributed so much, Chuck, you can't feel that way when you've lived with something for so long. And you have worked, had the privilege of working with one of the greatest American humorists. You feel very humble. I'm glad we didn't feel so humble at the time, because we might have been overwhelmed by what we were privileged to do, and that wouldn't have worked out so well. We had to keep just ordinary people. We had to remember that's what we were, and we did, because we weren't quite as aware as we are as time goes by of what we were allowed to participate in.
Well, but you know, don't underestimate yourself either, because...
I don't think I do. I was full of ambition as an actress, and finally realized I was at home, completely at home, as I'm sure the others in the cast felt always, and as did the audience. That's the wonderful part of it. Because Paul didn't stand outside looking in at anybody, as you know, Paul Reimer, the writer, the great author. He lived it. He was part of the human race, and he enjoyed and delighted in the little weaknesses, foibles, and eccentricities of us as we walked into the studio. He would point up in a forthcoming script some of the seemingly idiotic things we said and did, and just as human beings. But he was not standing aside doing that, not as in our town. He was living it himself.
Uh-huh.
And you felt welcome. It's like he said to the whole world, welcome to the human race. And you remember Ray Bradbury once said, life is full of big things, but it's more full of little ones.
That's right. Well, he certainly did capture the little things and actually made a big thing out of it.
Yes, he did. And as people became aware, well, that's true. And also, the overweening feeling was that we are essentially good. Because that man, Mr. Reimer himself, was good down to the marrow. And I mean that with a capital G. As Ray Bradbury pointed out once, just plain good. I don't think he had a flaw. I never heard him say anything against anybody or carp or criticize. He was a unique human in that way. And you felt embarrassed if you came out with what is now called a cheap shot at somebody else. Uh-huh. So we learned so very much, and we're also grateful. And Chuck, will you say hello to my fellow workers, Billy Adelson and Uncle Fletcher, Clarence Arzo?
Well, you just did it yourself.
We'll be with you, and sorry I can't be there.
Let me ask a question, Bernadine Flynn, about the day-to-day operation of the Vic and Sage show. How far in advance of the actual broadcast, of an actual broadcast, did you get the script?
Sometimes just before the rehearsal time. It just depended on... Paul never had a day off from the time he started writing.
Mm-hmm.
Unless he made it himself. And he was... an extremely careful writer. He didn't just sit down and let things roll out of his head through his hands and pen. He wrote carefully, and as he said, some days it came more easily than others. Well, NBC at one time, somebody tried to establish a deadline. Scripts must be ready 2 weeks in advance, and Mr. Rammer just couldn't do that because he couldn't sacrifice quality for quantity and speed. So we never lived up to that, and it didn't matter to us because once in the groove, we had to have rehearsal. That is true because the timing on those scripts has to be very carefully done. But Mr. Reimer sat in on rehearsals, never offered a word of criticism, nor even a suggestion. He made his suggestions as he wrote it. They were written in. He would say things like, when Sade would ask a question of Vic, I saw you talking to Mr. Donahue, how's he today? And it would say, Sade not really caring too much about it, you know, just an offhand question. Mm-hmm. Just to be polite to your husband when he walks in the door. And so little things like that would require his specific attention, or he would underline a word. But never did he speak up and tell us to, never tried to direct us. And but the timing had to be just right. If you look at the scripts and you see that it's interrupted conversation. People don't speak in long sentences in any conversation, really, if there are two or three people gathered together, or even two. They're constantly interrupting each other. Thoughts flow so fast and freely. And in his careful writing, that had to take place at the right time, at the right word. So it required rehearsal. Me say that, which we thoroughly enjoyed, and but with the scripts, no, we didn't get them in advance.
So you got the script just before the rehearsal for the program that was actually being broadcast.
Sometimes, oh no, the day before.
The day before.
The rehearsal was the day before.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have a working rehearsal, and then no, I don't remember ever getting a script on the day of the broadcast. That probably did happen when somebody was ill for a day or something like that. Paul had to produce a script writing out some one character, leaving in the others.
Uh-huh. You were involved in a number of broadcasts there where there maybe only was one character, just to say it on the air.
Well, that happened to all of the characters, yes. And people weren't aware of it.
Uh-huh.
They can say it was alive with so many characters being talked about or on the other end of the telephone wire that it scarcely made any difference. I'd talk to people after a broadcast. I did one day, Sadie on the telephone. Nobody else was present. And I asked, in fact, a sister of mine who listened every day, and I said, which show was that today? Pretending that I had couldn't remember because we'd already rehearsed the next day's show. And she listed the people who were on it. And I said, well, you're wrong. I was alone in the studio. So they weren't aware. And that would happen. Vic and Rush would have nice talks. And they'd talk about Sade or Uncle Fletch or something. And you weren't aware that they weren't right on the spot.
Mm-hmm. Well, you figure they were just in the other room.
Yeah, that's right. Of course.
What kind of reaction did you get from listeners?
Oh, that was exciting because some of the great humorists of the day either wrote directly to Paul or got in touch with him or wrote about him in articles. James Thurber in The New Yorker, and Hendrik Willem van Loon, Julius Williams, countless people like that. But the regular sustaining audience, we got an elation of joyous delight. They felt, I think, as we did, the actors, they were at home.
Mm-hmm.
Some may not know or didn't know, or to this day, just why they felt so at home. Because, as again, thinking of Ray Bradbury's descriptions of ants at a universal picnic, we're all there. It's our picnic, and there we are. And it's a wonderful feeling.
Did you ever receive gifts from the audience, listeners? Did they ever send things to you? And they send you some wash rags from their local department store?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, countless items like that. But we didn't encourage that. Unfortunately, we were gifted with many food gifts. And after going through the mails and everything, they weren't always too palatable. So we tried in writing to them to discourage any such contributions.
But how did you handle the fan mail? Did you answer much of it yourself?
Mr. Vambershot, Art Van Harvey, who played Vic, was better at that than I was. I was raising children, family, and I just didn't get around to do much fan mail, but the press department at NBC was very good about, and they would consult us about certain letters and our feelings about it or what to say. They sat in every day at one member of the press at the show, watched the show and followed it carefully, and they were great. In that department.
Did you do the show standing before microphones, or were you seated around the table?
Both.
Both.
It depended upon the script and so on and so forth. And when I was heavy with child, I remember sitting most of the time. And Mr. Van Harvey had a heart attack. For about 6 months, we did it from his bedroom in his in his apartment, because he had to be in bed.
So Vic, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was going to say Vic and Say was actually a remote for a while, huh?
Yes.
Kind of a bedside network broadcast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. So we did it every which way. And
that's quite a tribute to Mr. Van Harvey, also the other people, and, of course, to the show itself that the network would be willing to put together a thing like that.
Oh yes. They were all set up to broadcast from the hospital when I had my children, but then decided that was unnecessary. Paul wrote so well without me or without some other character, they could afford to be sick or incarcerated in a hospital for a week or so without the taxing Mr. Reimer too much.
You folks would have to take separate vacations then, wouldn't you?
Yes. But we had many trips together, joining Paul Whiteman in New York at one time. We were all invited there for a special radio celebration, at which Mr. Whiteman's show hosted.
Uh-huh.
And various places like that, Cleveland, Cincinnati. So we did make, over the weekend, usually, those things occurred. And so we did a bit of old-time troop traveling.
Uh-huh. It must have been very interesting. Here you folks, the four of you in that show were major radio stars, and yet you could walk up and down the street and people would not recognize you at all.
That was a wonderful part of it. We were just exactly what we were, just ordinary people walking around, and that's the way we felt. And if we had felt otherwise, we'd have been no good for that show.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't be around Mr. Reimer very long and think you were terribly special, because he didn't think he was.
Uh-huh. Well, he was, and so were all of you. Did you anybody ever recognize a voice in a store or a restaurant or someplace and say, I know you?
No, I don't recall that ever happening. Mm-mm.
Now,
except when I might be in the company, a large company of let's say radio artists or something,
mm-hmm,
like that,
mm-hmm,
they would be apt to recognize the voice. Otherwise, no.
Uh-huh. What was, can you recall, if you think back a few years, not too many years, I guess, but can you recall perhaps a special moment from a Vic and Sade broadcast that may have meant something extra special to you?
So many that they crowd in on my thoughts. It's strange, but not a day went by when there wasn't something in the script that tugged and pulled at you. And that was true for all listeners. They'd say the same thing. I can't recall any particular one.
Did you folks often see each other socially outside of the NBC studios?
Yes. Not a great deal, because we spent so much time in the studios together. The rest of the time was really reserved for our own families. No, we didn't live any special kind of back and forth lives in the social respect, but knew each other well and met on occasions. And enjoyed each other's company, whether it was at a rehearsal or the broadcast or outside of the studios.
It's interesting that the University of Chicago would single out Vic and Sade, the show, as a tremendous representation of the so-called Chicago School of Comedy.
Mm-hmm.
There were a great many contributors to the Chicago School of Comedy as far as radio is concerned, and I think at those the hallowed halls of NBC up there in the 19th floor of the Merchandise Mart, there were some of your contemporaries in those days contributing an awful lot to comedy.
Oh, yes, of course there were.
You had, I believe, Jim and Marion Jordan were there.
Yes, oh yes, I worked with them many times on their shows, just doing odd characters.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Any shows that originated in Chicago, most of us. Art Van Harvey did a lot of, he was a great dialectician.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely good. And I remember once I had an audition at NBC for a show that what was to have as its main characters two men, one Italian and one Jewish. And when they'd have those auditions, of course, they were blind auditions. That is, the sponsors, of the possible sponsors, advertising agencies, and NBC brass, as they say, would be in an isolated booth just listening, not looking into the studio, because they could get a better perception of how it would sound to listeners.
Mm-hmm.
So they would call couple number one, couple number two, and that's the way auditions were run, whether it was a man and woman lead, or in this case, the comics, the Italian and Jewish comedian, two men. And so they would try them out, and then the call would come down to have, in couple number one, the Italian, and in couple number seven, the Jewish actor. And they finally got the pair that they wanted, and both of the men were Art Van Harvey. So they couldn't have it. He'd have been talking, he was the best in both categories.
No, he's liable to be talking to himself.
Yeah.
When did your, I know you started with Vic and Sade in 1932, when did your radio career begin, Bernadine Flynn?
About 30, the spring of 31, or the fall of 30.
And what were you doing? How did you first get into the radio scene?
Oh, well, I was in New York. I had, after college, I went directly to New York full of ambition for the theater, and did some theater work. I was able to get in, did a little work for the Guild, and worked for some good directors. But it was the year of the stock market crash, and shows opened and closed. That was good training ground, but nothing lasted very long. By the middle of winter, there were plenty of well-known actors and actresses out of work. And radio was coming up, and somebody suggested radio. I thought I'd better get back to Chicago, where perhaps there weren't so many legitimate theater thespians at loose, and I wouldn't have so much competition. So that's why I came back, Chicago being near my home, which was Madison, Wisconsin. And I felt more, this is my territory. So then went into radio.
And that was right here, and boom, wasn't too long after that.
That's right.
You found yourself in really the premier radio show.
Right. Mm-hmm. Lucky from the start.
Talented from the start.
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, I don't know. A professor wrote me years later from Wisconsin, my dramatic coach, and said that some people, you know, they're born great. And some achieve greatness. Some have it thrust upon them, and underlined was thrust. And it was a letter of congratulations when I was receiving some small honor from the University of Wisconsin. And I realized how accurate she was. It had been what, if not greatness exactly, but what renown I was reaping had been thrust upon me. And she was aware of it. Quite aware, and people keep you straight, you know, through the years.
Uh-huh.
You keep your checks and balances. Somebody does it for you.
Well, you did a great job for us, and for all of those of us who enjoyed tuning in to you and the others, part of the Vic and Sade series. I'd like to say thank you very much for your contribution to that show and to radio and to the lives of so many people.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Chuck, for what you're doing. Also convey my thanks to Marcia Cassidy, who is doing a wonderful job with the Extension Division. This is a beautiful thing that's being done, and I don't understand how it became so beautifully coordinated except because of you wonderful people. And I'm sorry, but I'll be with you thinking of you every minute.
Well, I understand there's going to be a tape made of the evening, and we'll see that you get a copy of it.
Oh, thank you. I can't wait.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bernadine Flynn. It's been a great pleasure chatting with you today.
Been fun, Chuck. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.